72 confirmed cases with 69 deaths. And from the Texas Tribune, COVID-19 hospitalizations new daily cases dropped to lowest points since June. 4,203 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 31st, 816 less than a week ago. They occupy 7.7% of hospital beds. 2,374 new cases were reported on August 31st. The latest positivity rate is 12%. 12,536 Texans have died as of August 31st, 26 more deaths reported than a day before, and 1,141 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $43.11, and that's up 50 cents. Now we'll look at coronavirus briefs. The United States has reported more than 6 million known coronavirus cases, the latest milestone in a summer of shattered records for new infections. The country's known cases have more than tripled since June 1st, as the pandemic accelerated beyond the East Coast, and over the past week, infections have trended upward in parts of the Midwest, including Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, and the Dakotas. There are at least 180,000 coronavirus-related deaths in the United States. Three vaccines are now in phase three trials in the U.S. British drug maker AstraZeneca announced Monday its vaccine candidate had entered this phase. Now here are some short articles. Boosting these early immune defenses might be a way to fight COVID-19. Researchers across the planet are racing to harness one of our immune system's frontline defenders as an early treatment for COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus that has killed more than 800,000 people globally. Until now, early-stage treatments have remained elusive, but an improved understanding how the virus disarms some of the body's immune fighters, called interferons, is creating excitement among scientists who theorize they might be able to counter that process and prevent infections from developing into severe disease. Interferons are immune proteins that normally interfere with a virus's life cycle, hence the name interferon. In addition to their antiviral properties, they summon natural killer cells, the best soldiers, as it were, of the innate immune system. Anthony S. Fauci, director of NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said in an interview. World Health Organization warns against opening too soon. No country can just pretend the pandemic is over. WHO Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned Monday that countries risk reopening too soon if the pandemic is still raging. WHO fully supports efforts to reopen economies and societies, Tedros said at a news conference in Geneva. We want to see children returning to school and people returning to the workplace, but we want to see it done safely. No country can just pretend the pandemic is over, the WHO chief said, adding that the reality is that this coronavirus spreads easily, it can be fatal to people of all ages, and most people remain susceptible. The remarks come amid movements to reopen businesses and send children in to begin a new school year, despite surges in new cases in many nations or lingering spread. The more control countries have over this virus, the more they can open up, Tedros said. Opening up without having control is a recipe for disaster. Tedros and other WHO officials also spoke at length about the global push to develop a vaccine, celebrating the $470 million pledge from the European Union to a global vaccine initiative that it is helping with. WHO chief scientist Soumya Swaminathan also warned, however, that while countries have the right to use emergency authorizations to approve vaccines without full trials, it is not something that you do lightly. Global survey shows 74% of people are willing to get a coronavirus vaccine. About three-quarters of people surveyed around the world say they'd be willing to get a coronavirus vaccine if one came out, with the most enthusiasm in China and the least in Russia. The poll conducted by Ipsos for the World Economic Forum surveyed nearly 20,000 people across 27 countries. The survey showed 74% of all adults surveyed would get the vaccine if it were available. China had the highest support for vaccination, with 97% of those surveyed saying they would get immunized. Russians showed the least interest, with just 54% saying they would. 67% of Americans said they'd get the vaccine, while 33% expressed little or no interest. Of those who said they would refuse, 60% said side effects were their biggest worry, and 37% said they did not think it will be effective. Only 40% of all respondents expect a vaccine to be available this year. Experts expressed concern that more than a quarter of people worldwide would not get the vaccine. The 26% shortfall in vaccine confidence is significant enough to compromise the effectiveness of rolling out a COVID-19 vaccine, said Arnaud Bernhardt, head of Shaping the Future of Health and Healthcare at the World Economic Forum, in a statement. Here's how long it took the U.S. to reach 6 million COVID-19 cases. There have been more than 6 million cases of coronavirus reported in the United States, according to a survey compiled by Johns Hopkins University. JHU recorded the first case of coronavirus in the U.S. on January 21st. Here's how the country got to more than 6 million. It took the country 99 days to reach 1 million cases on April 28th. It then took 43 more days to reach 2 million cases on June 10th. It took another 28 days to surpass 3 million cases on July 8th. It took the U.S. only 15 additional days to surpass 4 million cases on July 23rd. It took the U.S. 17 days to go to over 5 million cases. It has taken the nation 22 days since then to reach 6 million cases. Only two other countries in the world have over 1 million reported COVID-19 cases, Brazil and India. But there's a bit of good news for the U.S., according to health experts. As a nation, we are clearly doing better now on the last day of August than we were on the first day of August, Dr. Ashish Jha, director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, said. Daily cases have come down. Deaths are starting to decline. Hospitalizations are down. This is good news, and it's largely because of smart policies in Texas and Arizona and Florida around masking and closing bars, Jha said. But there are still parts of the country where things are both bad and even getting worse. In the Dakotas, in Kansas, and other states, we still see a lot of cases. And as a nation, we're still seeing a lot of cases of coronavirus. So, progress, but we have a long way to go. And now I'll start reading longer articles related to vaccines. From CNN. Past vaccine disasters show why rushing a coronavirus vaccine now would be colossally stupid. Vaccine experts are warning the federal government against rushing out a coronavirus vaccine before testing has shown it's both safe and effective. Decades of history show why they're right. FDA signals vaccine could green light early. They're concerned that the FDA may be moving too quickly, heightened when FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn told the Financial Times that his agency could consider an emergency use authorization, EUA, for a COVID-19 vaccine before late-stage clinical trials are complete, if the data shows strong enough evidence it would protect people. The commissioner has the authority to allow unapproved medical products to be used in an emergency when there are no adequate or approved alternatives. An EUA is not the same as full approval, and it can be withdrawn. That's what happened with hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. The FDA granted an EUA to the drugs, much praised by President Donald Trump, on March 28th. It subsequently revoked its EUA in June after studies showed that they were not effective and could also potentially cause serious heart problems. Vaccine approval. For a vaccine to be FDA approved, scientists must gather enough data through clinical trials and large numbers of volunteers to prove it is safe and effective at protecting people against a disease. Once the data is collected, FDA advisors usually spend months considering it. An EUA is much quicker. Only once before has the FDA given a vaccine this lesser standard approval of an EUA, but it was in an unusual circumstance. Soldiers had sued, claiming a mandatory anthrax vaccine made them sick, and a judge put a hold on the program. The Department of Defense asked for an EUA that then overrode the court ruling in 2005, so it could continue vaccinating military personnel, this time on a voluntary basis. Otherwise, vaccines have had to go through the entire clinical trial process and FDA approval process, which can take months or years. When the vaccine-making process has been rushed, there have been bad outcomes. The Qatar incident. On April 12, 1955, the government announced the first vaccine to protect kids against polio. Within days, labs had made thousands of lots of the vaccine. Batches made by one company, Qatar Labs, accidentally contained live polio virus, and it caused an outbreak. More than 200,000 children got the polio vaccine, but within days, the government had to abandon the program. 40,000 kids got polio. Some had low levels. A couple hundred were left with paralysis, and about 10 died, said Dr. Howard Markle, a pediatrician, distinguished professor, and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. The government suspended the vaccination program until it could determine what went wrong. Monkey trouble. However, increased oversight failed to discover another problem with the polio vaccine. From 1955 to 1963, between 10% and 30% of polio vaccines were contaminated with simian virus 40, SV40. The way they would grow the virus was on monkey tissues. These rhesus macaques were reported from India, tens of thousands of them, medical anthropologist S. Lachlan Jane said. They were gang-chained, and in those conditions, the ones that didn't die on the journey, many got sick, and the viruses spread quickly, added Jane, who taught a history of vaccines course at Stanford and is working on a publication about the incident. Scientists wrongly thought that the formaldehyde they used would kill the virus. It was being transferred to millions of Americans, Jane said. Many believe this issue wasn't adequately pursued, Jane said. Some studies showed a possible link between the virus and cancer. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control website, however, said most studies are reassuring and find no link. No current vaccines contain SV40 virus, the CDC says, and there's no evidence the contamination harmed anyone. The epidemic that never was. In 1976, scientists predicted a pandemic of a new strain of influenza called swine flu. More than 40 years later, some historians call it flu epidemic that never was. President Ford was basically told by his advisors that, look, we have a pandemic flu coming called swine flu that may be as bad as Spanish flu, said Michael Kinch, a professor of radiation oncology in the School of Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. His latest book, Between Hope and Fear, explores the history of vaccines. Ford was being cajoled to put forward a vaccine that was hastily put together. When you have a brand new strain situation like that, they had to do it on the fly, Kinch said. Ford made the decision to make the immunization compulsory. The government launched the program in about 7 months, and 40 million people got vaccinated against swine flu, according to the CDC. That vaccination campaign was later linked to cases of a neurological disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which can develop after an infection or, rarely, after vaccination with a live vaccine. Unfortunately, due to that vaccine and the fact that it was done so hastily, there were a few hundred cases of Guillain-Barré, although it's not definitive that they were linked, Kinch said. The CDC said the increased risk was about one additional case of Guillain-Barré for every 100,000 people who got the swine flu vaccine. Due to this small association, the government stopped the program to investigate. It was kind of a fiasco, Markle said. The good news is that there was never an epidemic of swine flu, so we were safe, but that shows you what could happen. Growing distrust in the U.S. It took several incidents for people to start distrusting vaccines. Even after thousands of kids got sick from the first polio vaccine in 1955, when the program restarted, parents made sure their children got vaccinated. They had clear memories of epidemics that paralyzed between 13,000 and 20,000 children every year. Some were so profoundly paralyzed that they could not even breathe easily on their own and relied on machines called iron lungs to help them breathe. Parents were pushing their kids to get to the head of the line to get the polio vaccine, because they had seen epidemics every summer for years and saw kids in iron lungs, and they were terrified, Markle said. Markle said people's attitudes started to change between 1955 and the problematic 1976 swine flu vaccination project. You've got civil rights when people see the cops beating the hell out of people on TV. You've got the Vietnam War where people start to get disgusted with the killing. You've got Watergate, when the president is literally lying through his teeth, Markle said. That led to a real distrust of authorities and federal government, and it extended to doctors and scientists, and that's only progressed as time has gone along. A colossally stupid move. Markle said people's mistrust of the system makes the idea that the FDA would rush this process before late-stage clinical trials are complete, colossally stupid. This is one of the most ridiculous things I've heard this administration say, Markle said. All it takes is one bad side effect to basically botch a vaccine program that we desperately need against this virus. It's a prescription for disaster. FDA Commissioner Hahn said that the vaccine decision will be based on data, not politics, but Kinch shares Markle's concern. This could do substantial damage, Kinch said. Kinch, who is a patient in one of the vaccine trials himself, said the clinical trial process needs to be followed to the end. A too early EUA for a vaccine could cause a nightmare scenario for a few reasons. One, the vaccine may not be safe. Two, if it is not safe, people will lose faith in vaccines. Three, if a vaccine doesn't offer complete protection, people will have a false sense of security and increase their risk. Four, if a substandard vaccine gets an EUA, a better vaccine may never get approval because people would be reluctant to enroll in trials and risk getting a placebo instead of a vaccine. People are going to die unnecessarily if we take chances with this, Kinch said. We've got to get this right. Here's our next article, this also from CNN. Experts call for independent commission separate from FDA to review COVID-19 vaccines. Citing criticism of government agencies and increasing public distrust of vaccines, several prominent physicians and experts are calling for the creation of an independent commission to review data from coronavirus vaccine trials before a vaccine is allowed on the market. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration regulates vaccines, and it's okay is all that's needed to put one on the market. The physicians fear, however, that after several government blunders during the pandemic, a layer of review independent from the government is needed to give Americans confidence that the shot is safe and effective. A CNN poll this month shows that 40% of Americans do not want to get a coronavirus vaccine when it becomes available, even if it's free and easy to access. Such a low uptake of the vaccine could hinder the ability to get the virus under control and return to normalcy. Dr. Catherine Stevenson, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, said she thought of the idea of an independent panel to increase trust in the vaccine after several colleagues told her they did not want to get a coronavirus vaccine when it becomes available. I'm tired of hearing this from my peers, from doctors and nurses. They're not anti-vaxxers. They're pro-vaccine. They vaccinated their own children. But they are skeptical about this vaccine, said Stevenson, director of the Clinical Trials Unit at the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Separately from Stevenson, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan arrived at the same conclusion. We're used to this world where if the FDA or CDC or NAS says something is safe and effective, that's enough. But I don't think this time that's sufficient to overturn public skepticism, said Kaplan, director of medical ethics at NYU Langone Health, referring to the Centers for Disease Control and the National Academy of Sciences. I think we desperately need an independent national commission. Assurances from the FDA. Stephanie Cocomo, an FDA spokeswoman, pointed CNN to an August 18th blog in Health Affairs by FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn and two other physicians at the agency that describes steps the agency is taking to offer reassurance that any potential vaccine will be safe and effective. First, the agency established clear recommendations for vaccine performance prior to the initiation of Phase 3 trials to provide assurance that any authorized vaccine will meet appropriate standards for safety and effectiveness. Second, FDA has committed to use an advisory committee composed of independent experts to ensure deliberations about authorization or licensure are transparent for the public, according to the blog written by Hahn, Dr. Anand Shah, and Dr. Peter Marks. Hahn has repeatedly made such assurances to the public. I can promise you that when the data are available, FDA will review them using its established rigorous and deliberative scientific process, Hahn told Dr. Susan Bailey, the president of the American Medical Association, at a video briefing earlier this month. We all understand that only by engaging in an open review process and relying on good science and sound data can the public and you as providers have confidence in the integrity of our decisions. Hahn added that clinical trial data will be reviewed by an FDA advisory committee, which will give us their guidance on any decision that we make. That committee is scheduled to meet on October 22nd. More than half the members of the panel are academic experts who are employed by universities and research centers. To some experts, Hahn's words about the advisory committee are at least somewhat reassuring and negate the need to create another panel. An independent commission already exists. We're not FDA employees, said Dr. Paul Offit, a vaccinologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who is a member of the FDA advisory committee. We don't need another level of bureaucracy. But Kaplan, the NYU ethicist, said he worries that many Americans don't trust experts anymore, no matter how reputable they might be. We're going to have to get past this relying on expert endorsement. It's an old-school way of thinking from pre-COVID days, he said. Sounds like a hot mess. Stevenson, Kaplan, and others say while they respect the scientific and ethical rigor of researchers such as Offit, they think many Americans will be skeptical of the findings of an FDA committee, especially since some of its members work for pharmaceutical companies and government agencies, according to the roster currently on the FDA website. The whole topic of COVID vaccines is already politicized, and many people's skepticism is fairly entrenched at this point, Stephen tweeted on August 22nd. I'd like to see an independent COVID-19 vaccine commission whose sign-off is required for FDA approval. Multiple factors have intensified the public skepticism about the vaccine, the doctors told CNN. First, the name of the government's vaccine program, Operation Warp Speed, can give the impression that the research is being hurried and therefore could yield an unsafe vaccine. Two, other government efforts have struggled since the beginning of the pandemic. The CDC was late getting COVID-19 diagnostic tests on the market, for example, and the FDA allowed antibody tests on the market that were inaccurate. The FDA issued an emergency authorization for the drug hydroxychloroquine to treat COVID-19, only to revoke that authorization less than 2 months later. More recently, the agency authorized the use of convalescent plasma, even though many experts think there's not enough data to show it works. Given the premature authorization of hydroxychloroquine and convalescent plasma, the FDA is perceived by many as tainted, said Dr. Rochelle Walensky, chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. Three, statements by government officials have not engendered confidence. Earlier this month, Hahn made a statistical error that dramatically overestimated the effectiveness of convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19, apologizing for the mistake the next day. A few days later, U.S. Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary Dr. Brett Geurer said the White House Coronavirus Task Force had discussed and approved a widely criticized decision to change CDC COVID-19 testing guidelines. Later that day, task force member Dr. Anthony Fauci said he was undergoing surgery at the time of discussions at the White House about the guideline changes. Then, Sunday, Hahn told the Financial Times that his agency could consider emergency use authorization or approval of a COVID-19 vaccine before Phase 3 trials are complete. I'm afraid that for the public, this sounds like a hot mess, and that's going to carry forward to the vaccines as well, Stevenson said. Stevenson says it's not that she doesn't trust the vaccine approval process. In fact, she's on a team at Harvard researching a vaccine to be produced by Johnson & Johnson. I believe in the power of vaccines, and I'm optimistic that we will get a safe and effective vaccine. I still want to fight for that, and I want the public to come with us on this journey, Stevenson said. And having an apolitical and independent group could reassure the public during a very partisan time. Looking to the UK as an example, the possibility that the entire vaccine approval system will be upended with an extra layer of review is unlikely, but that hasn't stopped doctors from advocating for it. Dr. Joseph Tucker, an infectious disease specialist at the University of North Carolina, saw Stevenson's August 22nd tweet and reached out to her, suggesting that they look at an independent panel in the UK that makes recommendations to the government on COVID-19, called the Independent Sage. He said he already knows he would want a U.S. independent panel to look different. The British committee is made up of experts, but Tucker envisions having coronavirus survivors as well as trusted community and religious leaders on any U.S. panel, as well as vaccine experts. I want to have a body that's really trusted. What if members were like, say, Oprah, people who are reasonable and have large followings in the U.S. and are not political and are widely recognized as thoughtful, Tucker said. Walensky, the infectious disease specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital, likes the idea and thinks back to the early days of the HIV epidemic when gay men protested to take part in policy decisions. When they were doing die-ins in front of the NIH, Dr. Fauci said, "Let them in. I want to hear what they have to say," said Walensky, referring to the top infectious disease doctor at the National Institutes of Health. They had a voice at the table. Something similar could be done for COVID-19 decisions, including the reviews of coronavirus vaccines, she said. The panel would have the community's best interest at heart, she said. It's not the scientists speaking to the community, but the community speaking to the community. Now here's an article from the New York Times. What if the first coronavirus vaccines aren't the best? Dozens of research groups around the world are playing the long game, convinced that their experimental vaccines will be cheaper and more powerful than the ones leading the race today. 7 months into the coronavirus crisis, with more than 30 vaccines rapidly advancing through the rigorous stages of clinical trials, a surprising number of research groups are placing bets on some that have not yet been given to a single person. The New York Times has confirmed that at least 88 candidates are under active preclinical investigation in laboratories across the world, with 67 of them slated to begin clinical trials before the end of 2021. Those trials may begin after millions of people have already received the first wave of vaccines. It will take months to see if any of them are safe and effective. Nevertheless, the scientists developing them say their designs may be able to prompt more powerful immune responses, or be much cheaper to produce, or both, making them the slow and steady winners of the race against the coronavirus. The first vaccines may not be the most effective, said Ted Ross, the director of the Center for Vaccines and Immunology at the University of Georgia, who is working on an experimental vaccine he hopes to put into clinical trials in 2021. Many of the vaccines at the front of the pack today try to teach the body the same basic lesson. They deliver a protein that covers the surface of the coronavirus, called spike, which appears to prompt the immune system to make antibodies fight it off. But some researchers worry that we may be pinning too many hopes on a strategy that has not been proved to work. It would be a shame to put all our eggs in the same basket, said David Wiesler, a virologist at the University of Washington. In March, Dr. Wiesler and his colleagues designed a vaccine that consists of millions of nanoparticles, each one studded with 60 copies of the tip of the spike protein, rather than the entire thing. The researchers thought these bundles of tips might pack a stronger immunological punch. When the researchers injected these nanoparticles into mice, the animals responded with a flood of antibodies to the coronavirus, much more than produced by a vaccine containing the entire spike. When the scientists exposed vaccinated mice to the coronavirus, they found that it completely protected them from infection. The researchers shared their initial results this month in a paper that has yet to be published in a scientific journal. Icosavax, a startup company co-founded by Dr. Wiesler's collaborator, Neil King, is preparing to begin clinical trials of the nanoparticle vaccine by the end of this year. U.S. Army researchers at the Walter Reed Army Institute have created another spike-tip nanoparticle vaccine, and they are recruiting volunteers for a clinical trial that they also plan to start by the end of 2020. A number of other companies and universities are creating spike-tip-based vaccines as well, using recipes of their own. Immune punch. Antibodies are only one weapon in the immune arsenal. Blood cells, known as T cells, can fight infections by attacking other cells that have been infiltrated by the virus. We still don't know which kind of immune response will be important for protection, said Luciano Lietti, a vaccine researcher at Instituto Butantan in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It's possible that vaccines that arouse only antibody responses will fail in the long run. Dr. Lietti and other researchers are testing vaccines made of several parts of the coronavirus to see if they can coax T cells to fight it off. It's a second line of defense that might work better than antibodies, said Anne de Groot, the CEO of Epivax, a company based in Providence, Rhode Island. Epivax has created an experimental vaccine with several pieces of the spike protein as well as other viral proteins, which it plans to test in a clinical trial in December. The effectiveness of a vaccine can also be influenced by how it gets into our body. All of the first wave vaccines now in clinical trials have to be injected into muscle. A nasal spray vaccine, similar to flu mist for influenza, might work better since the coronavirus invades our bodies through the airway. Several groups are gearing up for clinical trials of nasal spray vaccines. One of the most imaginative approaches comes from a New York company called Codagenix. They are testing a vaccine that contains a synthetic version of the coronavirus that they made from scratch. The Codagenix vaccine is a new twist on an old formula. For decades, vaccine makers have created vaccines for diseases such as chickenpox and yellow fever from live but weakened viruses. Traditionally, scientists have weakened the viruses by growing them in cells of chickens or some other animal. The viruses adapt to their new host, and in the process, they become ill-suited for growing in the human body. The viruses still slip into cells, but they replicate at a glacial pace. As a result, they can't make us sick. But a small dose of these weakened viruses can deliver a powerful jolt to the immune system. Yet there are relatively few live weakened viruses, because making them is a struggle. It's really trial and error based, said Dr. Robert Coleman, the chief executive at Codagenix. You can never say exactly what the mutations are doing. The Codagenix scientists came up with a different approach. They sat down at a computer and edited the coronavirus's genome, creating 283 mutations. Then they created a piece of DNA containing their new genome and put it in monkey cells. The cells then made their rewritten viruses. In experiments on hamsters, the researchers found that their vaccine didn't make the animals sick, but it did protect them against the coronavirus. Codagenix is preparing to open a phase 1 trial of an intranasal spray with one of these synthesized coronaviruses as early as September. Two similar vaccines are in earlier stages of development. The French vaccine maker Valneva planned to start clinical trials in November on a far less futuristic design. We are approaching the pandemic with a rather conventional approach, said Thomas Lingelbach, the CEO of Valneva. Valneva makes vaccines from inactivated viruses that are killed with chemicals. Jonas Salk and other early vaccine makers found this recipe to work well. Chinese vaccine makers already have three such coronavirus vaccines in phase 3 trials. But Dr. Lingelbach still sees an opportunity for Valneva making its own. Inactivated virus vaccines have to meet very high standards for purification to make sure all the viruses are not viable. Valneva has already met those standards, and it's not clear if Chinese vaccines would. The United Kingdom has arranged to purchase 60 million doses of Valneva's vaccine, and the company is scaling up to make 200 million doses a year. Faster and cheaper production. Even if the first wave of vaccines work, many researchers worry that it won't be possible to make enough of them fast enough to tackle the global need. It's a numbers game. We need a lot of doses, said Florian Kramer, a virologist at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Some of the most promising first wave products, such as RNA vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer, are based on designs that have never been put into large-scale production before. The manufacturing math just doesn't add up, said Stefan Mueller, the chief scientific officer at Codagenix. Many of the second-wave vaccines wouldn't require a large scale-up of experimental manufacturing. Instead, they could piggyback on standard methods that have been used for years to make safe and effective vaccines. Codagenix, for example, has entered into a partnership with the Serum Institute of India to grow their recoded coronaviruses. The Institute already makes billions of doses of live, weakened virus vaccines for measles, rotaviruses, and influenza, growing them in large tanks of cells. Tapping into well-established methods could also cut down the cost of a coronavirus vaccine, which will make it easier to get distributed to less wealthy countries. Researchers at Baylor College of Medicine, for example, are doing preclinical work on a vaccine that they said might cost as little as $2 a dose. By contrast, Pfizer is charging $19 a dose in a deal with the U.S. government, and other companies have floated even higher prices. To make the vaccine, the Baylor team engineered yeast to make coronavirus spike tips. It's precisely the same method that has been used since the 1980s to make vaccines for hepatitis B. The Indian vaccine maker, Biological E, has licensed Baylor's vaccine and is planning phase one trials that will start this fall. They now already know they can make a billion doses a year, said Maria Elena Botazzi, a Baylor virologist. It's easy breezy for them because it was exactly the same bread and butter vaccine technology that they have been working with for years. Even if the world gets cheap, effective vaccines against COVID-19, that doesn't mean all of our pandemic worries are over. With an abundance of other coronaviruses lurking in wild animals, another COVID-like pandemic may not be far off, including Anhui Zefie in China, Osifax in France, and VBI in Massachusetts are developing universal coronavirus vaccines that might protect people from an array of the viruses, even those that haven't colonized our species yet. Many scientists see their ongoing vaccine work as part of a long game, one that the well-being of entire nations will depend on. Thailand, for example, is preparing to purchase COVID-19 vaccines developed overseas, but scientists there are also carrying out preclinical research of their own. At Chula Longkorn University, researchers have been investigating several potential candidates, including an RNA-based vaccine that will go into phase one studies by early 2021. The vaccine is similar to one that Pfizer is now testing in late-stage clinical trials, but these scientists want the security of making their own version. While Thailand has to plan for buying vaccines, we should do our best to produce our own vaccine as well, said Kiat Ruxruntham, a professor at Chula Longkorn University. If we are not successful this time, we will be capable to do much, much better in the next pandemic. That's all the time that we have to read longer articles, so I'm going to move to our pre-recorded stories, which are shorter. Our first story comes today from NPR. How to tell a real COVID-19 contact tracer's call from a scammer's.
State officials and federal agencies warn of a new phone scam. Callers pose as COVID-19 contact tracers to try to get your personal information. With us now via Skype to discuss this is reporter Julie Appleby of Kaiser Health News. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what does it sound like when you get a call from a fake contact tracer?
Well, you know, scammers are very creative. So officials are kind of telling me that there's various scenarios. But one of them goes something like this. Your phone rings and the person on the other end says they're calling you from your local health department to let you know that you've been in contact with someone who has COVID-19. And the person might say, hey, you need a COVID test. So sounds legit so far, right? But then they move in for their real objective, which is getting your credit card number or other payment information. You know, they might say something like, hey, we need that to bill you for sending you a test, for example. Basically, don't fall for that. Some scams also come in by text, and they ask you to click on a link. Do not click on the link.
You know, I'm thinking about how most scams play on people's greed or their gullibility. This is especially offensive, I think, because it plays on people's fear in the pandemic or plays even on their public spiritedness. People want to do the right thing and they're being taken advantage of.
Right. That's exactly right. And legitimate contact tracing is very important. It's one of the key things along with, you know, masking and social distancing that the public health experts are hoping will slow the spread of the virus. So this is particularly insidious.
How widespread is this?
You know, we're hearing it from states across the country, from Hawaii to Florida to Pennsylvania. There's a national warning out from the Federal Trade Commission and another from the Better Business Bureau. Some local neighborhood listservs I've seen and Facebook pages are also circulating a warning.
So I'm thinking about the fact that I might really get a real call from a real contact tracer. How can I tell the difference between the real person and the fake?
Okay, so a legitimate contact tracer does not ask for payment or seek any other financial information. So that's one way you can tell. Real tracers do not ask for your social security number. They will not provide the name of the patient with whom you had contact. And texts from these contact tracers simply let you know to expect a phone call, right? They don't contain a link. So if you do get a phone call, do a little homework. Ask for the person's name and their return phone number and say you will call them back. Then check with your local health department to confirm that this person is indeed doing contact tracing. That would be one way you could kind of counter that. And if you do get a call, don't be surprised if a real contact tracer asks you to confirm your address or date of birth. They need this information because they don't want to give sensitive health information to the wrong person. So they're trying to confirm your identity. Real tracers are going to also ask you for information about where you've been and who you've been in contact with during the days surrounding your diagnosis or exposure, and that's because they need that information to track it and warn others of potential exposure.
So a real contact tracer should be somebody I could find, whose identity I can confirm, who may ask me for personal information, but if they start trying to get money out of me, that's the obvious sign.
That's correct, or any kind of financial information. That is an obvious sign.
Julie, thanks so much for the warning.
Okay, thank you.
Julie Appleby of Kaiser Health News.
Now here's a report about a story that we have approached in this broadcast before, and that's about parents who are now trying to figure out how they can work when they need childcare. This story, however, approaches it from a different way. It's also enlarging it to not only consider what the parents themselves are going through, but also how it could cripple the Texas economy.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When the pandemic began in March here in Texas, daycare centers and schools closed, meaning many families lost childcare. It's been a real headache for parents and caregivers to have their kids at home while they work from home or leave to go to work. KUT Austin's Claire McInerney reports this issue isn't just a challenge for these caregivers. It's actually a bigger problem for the whole Texas economy.
On Friday, March 13th, Chase D. Anderson sat in the conference room at her office. She and her colleagues at the Children's Defense Fund had just been told they must work from home starting the next week, so the staff was meeting to discuss how to make that transition. Daily life was about to become unrecognizable in many ways, and for Anderson, one of her biggest challenges of the pandemic began that day.
My kids are right there, yeah. They were in the room with us in my office because I didn't have anywhere else to put them, so.
Her 6 and 7-year-old daughters were with her because the Austin Independent School District had abruptly canceled school that Friday. Soon, the city would order everyone to shelter in place, and she and her husband would be asking, what do we do with the kids? Obviously, they weren't the only people asking this question. Childcare has been a huge stressor for so many families over the last few months. But this is more than a logistical nightmare for families. It makes David Fagan really worried about the Texas economy.
The picture changes every day, but I'll say the last I heard, we had around 30% of Texas childcare providers were closed, and many, many more are on the verge. Many of those providers may never reopen.
Fagan is a policy associate at Texans Care for Children, and he views these centers being closed and financially struggling as dangerous to economic recovery. Because if kids have nowhere to go, then working parents have a much tougher time getting back to work.
And we're cognizant of the fact that there's pressure on them to return to work, both for their own personal needs, basic needs, and by their employers.
That's Jason Gindell. He runs Main Spring School, which is a nonprofit child care center that serves mostly families that are low income. And it's been closed since March.
I get an email, every day from a family member asking if we're going to reopen soon.
He hasn't yet, because the high infection rates and hospitalizations of COVID-19 in Austin this summer have made him wary. As cases have leveled off, he now plans to open September 8th. But finances are top of mind. He's been able to pay his staff thanks to a good savings account and a PPP loan. But once he reopens, he expects only 50 to 75% of the children to come back. And even though he'll have fewer children, he'll stay fully staffed in case someone gets sick and needs to quarantine.
And so that creates an upside down financial situation for us, right? We are suddenly under-enrolled, and so our income is going to be down.
While Maine Spring expects fewer students when it opens, the pandemic has forced some centers to turn away students. Latrice Jones is the assistant director at Open Door Preschool East, which has been open since April. Her organization didn't let all students come back. They figured with fewer students, that would mean less exposure to COVID-19. It does make her sad to know that they are denying families childcare and likely putting them in a hard financial position.
If we can't get childcare settled out, there's not a business that'll be able to last very long.
Jones says childcare centers need more money from the state and federal government so they can hire more teachers and bring more students back while also keeping them safe. In Austin, the city is starting to discuss this kind of support. Stephanie Hayden, the head of Austin Public Health, sent a memo to Mayor Adler and the city council asking for financial support to childcare centers. Her memo asks the city to give $12 to $15 million for one-time expenses to keep these providers afloat. And a previous resolution from the city council distributed $1 million to childcare centers. If there isn't more support, though, across the state, Fagan worries limited options for childcare could mean some parents will just stop working, which also hurts the economy.
How many parents are just going to decide they're better off quitting their job and not returning to the workforce because they can't afford to send their children there or they're afraid to?
Which is exactly where Anderson, the mom we heard from at the beginning, finds herself. The last 5 months have been difficult with two working parents and two school-aged children. She and her husband had a conversation toward the beginning of the pandemic and decided she would be mostly responsible for the kids during the day.
When one person earns a lot more than the other person does, you make these decisions. Like, if one of us is going to lose their job, if one of us is going to struggle at their job, it's not going to be the person who can support us, you know, on his own.
Now that her priority is to help her kids with school and not devote the same amount of time to her policy work, she does worry if she'll eventually lose her job. In Austin, I'm Claire McInerney for the Texas Standard.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
And that is your coronavirus update for this first day of September 2020. Coming up next, national news from the USA Today newspaper, and then our local news. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading at 3 o'clock. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Memorial Gardens Park will get makeover for Memorial. MISD board puts Riddick on administrative leave. Results matter for MC board member Green. Cornyn says unlicensed gun dealers need to be eliminated. From the Odessa American, solemn service remembers victims. Odessans gather for moment of silence. Rotary treats first responders. Cornyn in Odessa talking anniversary and COVID. Those are some of the articles we'll bring you at 3 o'clock this afternoon. At 6 o'clock... Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Each week, Dale and co-host Cheryl Cummings bring you new recipes and cooking tips, specifically for those who have low vision or no vision on cooking in the dark.
Oil is really hard to measure. I've got some measuring spoons on a ring here, and what I did was I just poured the olive oil in. I kind of held my thumb over the edge of it, and when I felt it kind of start to run over the side, I dumped it and then poured and filled it up again and dumped again.
A few months ago, everybody was trying to be healthy, and there was a ban. You couldn't bring in any candy.
That's usually good for like the first 2 weeks of the new year, you know, and then after that, it's out the window, man.
Yeah.
I've even made this before where I've used 2 packages of the dry ranch dip mix.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when somebody finds out you're blind? They talk louder. We even had a guy one time came up to Candace and I and told us we need to learn sign language because I was blind. I'm like, really?
Wednesdays at 8, Sundays at noon, and Mondays at midnight.
Cooking in the dark.
Cooking in the dark.
On Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 91 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This is Sister Eileen Bielman reporting from USA Today, Tuesday, September 1, 2020. Protests in USA, Kenosha. As anger boiled over, chaos ruled the streets. From the start, witnesses say, this night just felt different. Jeremiah just wanted to find his car and go home, but he was trapped. A line of police in riot gear had just forced him and hundreds of other protesters out of Kenosha's Civic Center Park and into the street. After that, there was nowhere to go. Soldiers and cops blocked one end of the road. White guys with big guns blocked the other. It was past 11 p.m. local time, August 25th, the third night of protests after a Kenosha police officer shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back. Jeremiah had received a text from a friend saying a bunch of protesters had their tires slashed. He wanted to get to his car before vandals did.